prices of food around the world are rising. The UN Food and Agricultural Organization says that prices this past December were as high as, what, the 2008 levels, when food shortages and riots were pervasive. And this is something that Lester Brown has been studying, well, pretty much most of your professional life. You're, what, a former MacArthur Fellow. You founded World Watch. You're now president of Earth Policy Institute. And you're here to fill us in on what's going on. Welcome.
My pleasure, Steve.
What's driving the current spike in world food prices? How is this related to rising population, recent crazy weather events? What's behind all this?
On the demand side, we now have three sources of growing demand for grain. One, population growth. That's not new, but there will be 219,000 people at the dinner table tonight who were not there last night, and the same for tomorrow night. That's 80 million people a year. The second thing is rising affluence. There are probably close to 3 billion people in the world today who want to move up the food chain and consume more grain-intensive livestock products, meat, milk, and eggs. The third thing is we're now converting substantial quantities of grain into oil, i.e. ethanol, fuel for cars. In the United States last year, we harvested almost exactly 400 million tons of grain. Of that, 119 million tons went to ethanol distilleries to produce automotive fuel.
And what about the supply side?
There are also several trends now making it more difficult and uncertain to expand food production. One is climate change. It used to be if we had a weather event someplace, a monsoon failure in India or drought in the former Soviet Union or what have you, we knew that if we could get through the next year that things would go back to normal. But there's no norm to go back to now. The world's climate is in a constant state of flux. The other thing that we used to be able to do, by the way, was during most of the last half century, whenever there was any disruption in world food supply and a spike in grain prices, at the Department of Agriculture, we would calculate how many million acres of idled cropland we needed to bring back into production with the next crop in order to reestablish a balance in the world. So we had that fallback, that cushion. We don't have that anymore. We don't have any cropland idled under farm programs.
In your book, you mention what you call a water-based food bubble. Can you please explain that?
Well, as the demand for food has been increasing throughout the world, many countries have expanded irrigation, even though it meant overpumping their aquifers. And if it's a fossil aquifer, it doesn't recharge. Then once you've depleted it, it's finished. And that's what's happened in Saudi Arabia. That's why their wheat production has collapsed in the last few years and will disappear entirely in the next year or two.
But there are not a lot of people in Saudi Arabia.
No, but there are a lot of people in India. And in India, most of the aquifers are replenishable aquifers. So if you overpump there, when you deplete the aquifer, the rate of pumping is necessarily reduced to the rate of recharge. And that's what countries like India and China are facing.
So in other words, they're extracting more water than actually recharges there.
That's right.
But they're behaving as if it's going to go on forever.
That's right. And we know that overpumping, by definition, is a short-term phenomenon.
So how are we going to be able to feed everyone as population continues to grow? Are we running out of food, or is it a distribution problem?
It's a real challenge. What we're seeing now is that the world's farmers are having trouble keeping up with the growth in demand from population growth, rising affluence, and producing fuel for cars from crops. And so we have this tight food situation and some of the highest food prices on record now, according to the UN's Food and Agricultural Organization. You mentioned December, but January prices went up further, and we're probably going to see even more price increases in the year ahead. And that brings political instability in a lot of lower-income countries.
You mentioned climate change in your book. Temperatures are rising around the world. How do crops and other plants react to this?
Well, one of the things we talk about in World on the Edge is the rule of thumb that crop ecologists have developed for measuring the effect of rising temperature on yields. And the rule of thumb is that for each 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature, that's 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, for each 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature, we can expect a 10% decline in grain yields. And so as the Earth's temperature rises, and it is rising and is projected to continue doing so, it's going to take a toll on grain harvests. I mean, we saw this most dramatically in Russia this past summer, where scorching temperatures reduced the grain harvest from roughly 100 million tons, which is what they were expecting, to 60 million tons.
So what you're saying, that even the present target that some people talk about, it keeping the warming to less than 2 degrees centigrade, is going to result in a 20% cut in our productivity for food on the planet? In the best case scenario that people talk about.
If that comes in the during the growing season, that's what we're looking at.
How much does food and water insecurity play into the very insecure situation we see now in the Middle East? As we're speaking, the situation in Egypt, of course, we've seen what happened in Tunisia. How is this related, if it is, to food and water?
All the countries in North Africa and in the Middle East, in the Arab Middle East, import grain. Some of them a small share of their consumption, some a large share. In Egypt, interestingly, we have a country importing over half of the grain it consumes and producing the other smaller half, if you will, with imported water via the Nile River. It basically doesn't rain in Egypt. I mean, rainfall is negligible to non-existent. So to produce food in Egypt, you have to have water coming from the Nile. The difficulty now is, with all the land grabs occurring in the countries in the upper Nile River basin, like the Sudan and Ethiopia, land acquisitions by the Chinese, the Koreans, the Saudis, and many other countries, when they acquire that land, they also acquire water in the upper part of the Nile Basin, which means there will be less water for Egypt to produce food with. So Egypt is faced with growing insecurity in its food supply, both because of the competition for imports among other countries now, and also because it's going to be getting less water coming down the Nile.
How much do you think food and water issues are playing in the present instability in Egypt and other countries in the Middle East?
It's hard to sort out, you know, unemployment and rising food prices and the frustrations of having a totalitarian government. But there's no question but that rising food prices is something that people relate to. Of all economic indicators, I think the most politically sensitive is food prices. And I think the rising food prices are playing a role. In the countries where we're seeing all the instability at the moment in North Africa and the Middle East.
So if rising food prices are linked to political instability, if you were to look at a map of the Middle East, what countries would you say, look out, there's a real potential for instability that could be aggravated at the least by rising food prices?
Probably the first thing you do would be to separate the oil exporting countries from the non-oil exporting countries in that region of the world.
Because?
Because the oil exporting countries can compete in the world market for imports. They have the purchasing power. But a country like Yemen, for example, produces very little oil to begin with, and even that is declining. They have no major exports to rely on. So as they lose their irrigation water supplies, which they are doing, they're going to be in a scramble mode. So it would be potentially one of the worst case scenarios. And it happens also to be a very sensitive country now politically, with Al-Qaeda using it to beginning to establish itself there, because it's the stepping stone to Saudi Arabia.
Let's look at the big countries that have to feed themselves. I'm thinking of China and India. What's the food situation in those two countries, and how might that impact the U.S.?
both countries are vulnerable because of overpumping, which is going to be reduced at some point in the not-too-distant future. It now looks as though China's going to be coming into the world market this year for substantial quantities of grain. When they come into the world market, they will almost certainly come to the United States because the United States is far and away the world's leading grain exporter. So for American consumers, this is a nightmare scenario because we're looking at the prospect of 1.4 billion Chinese with rapidly rising incomes competing with us for our grain harvest, driving up our food prices. In a country that's never faced a serious food security issue in the past, things are about to change. Now you can say, well, if they drive up our food prices too much, we'll restrict exports. But China's our banker. They're holding $900 billion of U.S. Treasury securities. Every month, the Treasury Department auctions off Treasury securities to cover our fiscal deficit. And the Chinese are one of the biggest buyers. So they're our banker now. Like it or not, we are going to be sharing our grain harvest with the Chinese, regardless of how much it drives up food prices.
Care to predict how much more it could cost us? I mean, right now, food is, what, 15% of the typical American's income?
We are somewhat insulated because if we buy a loaf of bread for $2, for example, the cost of the wheat in that loaf of bread is maybe 10 cents. So the price of wheat doubles, you add another 10% onto the loaf of bread. But if you live in northern India or Pakistan and you buy your wheat in the market, bring it home and then grind it into flour so you can make chapatis, if the price of wheat doubles, you feel it directly. That's the difference between the developing world and the industrialized world.
So what are the solutions here? In your book, you talk about making better use of water. What do you have in mind?
Well, water is emerging as a major constraint on efforts to expand world food production. And it's a situation not unlike that we faced in the 1950s when we suddenly realized that world population was going to double by the end of the century, and there wasn't much new land to bring under the plow. So we launched a major international effort to raise cropland productivity. As a result, the world grain yield in 2010 was triple that of 1950, grain yield per acre. This is worldwide. We now need to begin to engage the water issue and to launch an international effort to raise water productivity. And there are a lot of things we can do.
For example?
Moving to more water-efficient irrigation systems in some situations, pricing water at its real value so that farmers use it as though it's a valuable commodity instead of a free or very low-cost commodity.
Those sorts of things.
Yes.
But in the United States, what's the saying? Whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting?
Yeah. It's a politically sensitive issue. I mean, that's the point Mark Twain was making a long time ago about this. It's something we have to come to. I mean, it's like World War II when Roosevelt said we were going to ban the sale of automobiles. You know, it was not a politically popular thing necessarily, but people realized that it's what we had to do if we wanted to win the war.
So how much of the food squeeze is related to the amount of meat that we're consuming?
Well, in the industrial world, and increasingly in China, we're moving up the food chain. We estimate there are about 3 billion people in the world who are now who have rising incomes, who are moving up the food chain, consuming more grain-intensive meat, milk, eggs. In the United States and in many other industrialized countries, we are living rather high on the food chain. Too high for our own health in many cases. We're consuming too many fat-rich livestock products. So if we move down the food chain somewhat, we will be healthier as individuals and the planet will be healthier. So that's a win-win situation that we can all do something about.
So if the phone were to ring, Lester Brown, and it's the White House, they'd like to get a briefing on what one might do in the face of the world food situation. What would you tell them? And in particular, how would you define our security based on what you see in terms of food?
I would first of all say that this current situation, unlike the price surges in the last half of the last century, is not event-driven. It is trend-driven. That doesn't mean that events like the heat wave in Russia won't affect it, but it is trend-driven by trends on the population side, trends on the supply side. So we have to look at those trends and we have to deal with them. And it includes things like cutting carbon emissions very fast to stabilize climate. It means eradicating poverty and accelerating the shift to smaller families around the world. It means restoring the economy's natural support systems with forests and soils and aquifers and grasslands and fisheries. We're in the process of destroying those now. And no civilization has ever survived the ongoing destruction of its natural support systems, Mr. President, nor will ours. What we're now faced with is a need to redefine security. We have inherited a definition of security from the last century, which was dominated by two world wars and the Cold War. And so when you mention national security in the United States, people automatically think military. But if you were to sit down with a clean slate today and say, what are the leading threats to our future, and indeed to the future of civilization? It's not an armed superpower someplace that, it might attack us. It is climate change. It is population growth. It is falling water tables. It is rising food prices. It is failing states. Failing states are now a much greater threat to future political stability than overarmed superpowers. So I would say, Mr. President, we not only need to redefine security in a conceptual sense, but also in a fiscal sense, because what's needed to eradicate poverty, stabilize population, restore soils and forests and all these things comes to about $200 billion of additional expenditures a year. That's a lot, but it's less than a third of the U.S. military budget, and it's less than a seventh of the global military budget. So we can't say we can't do the things we need to do to save civilization, and that's what's really at stake now. It's not saving the planet anymore. I mean, we environmentalists have been talking about that for some time, but as I think about it, the planet's probably going to be around for some time. The question is, can civilization, as we know it, survive these mounting stresses if we don't get some of the trends generating the stresses, like water shortages and climate change and so forth, turned around?
So what you're saying, in essence, is security isn't a matter of guns so much anymore as it is butter.
Bread.
Bread and butter.
Bread and butter, yeah. Exactly. That's the message, Mr. President.
What would have happened if we'd had a drought in this country like they had, or a heat wave like they had in Russia last year?
Yeah, this is a disturbing question. It's a useful question with a disturbing answer, because if the heat wave that was centered in Moscow had instead been centered in Chicago, and we had lost 40% of our grain harvest, as the Russians did, we would have lost 160 million tons, not 40 million tons. 160 million tons is 40% of a 400 million ton grain harvest. If that had happened, there would now be chaos in world grain markets. What would have happened is that world grain stocks would have dropped the lowest level on record. We would have seen grain prices going off the top of the chart, even from the current level. Food prices would have been rising throughout the world. Grain exporting countries would have restricted exports to keep their food prices down, reducing the exportable supplies. Most likely, the oil exporting countries would have begun to barter oil for grain to make sure they could get the grain they needed. And much of the rest of the world, including many lower income developing countries, would have been left scrambling for the remaining crumbs. And that would have led to governments falling, food riots and demonstrations on a scale that we've not seen before. Because when people get really desperate, they do desperate things. I don't think we realize how close we are to the edge, which is why I called the book World on the Edge. I think we're much closer than most people realize.
Okay, give me some hope here, please, Lester Brown.
Well, one of the most exciting things happening in the world today is the effort to prevent the construction, the licensing of new coal-fired power plants in the United States. And that's been extraordinarily successful because of a strong grassroots movement.
Well, wait a second. How do you relate coal to eating food?
Climate change. coal is the leading source of carbon emissions, which is driving the change in climate. So the fact that we now have a de facto moratorium on the licensing of new coal plants. But beyond that, last year, U.S. utilities announced they were going to close 48 of the older, dirtier coal-fired power plants in the United States. That's 48 out of 600. So it's not all of them yet, but it's a major step in the right direction. And the campaign is gaining momentum now across the country as the Sierra Club and Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth and other groups begin to concentrate on closing the existing coal-fired power plants. This could become a model for the world.
I know people ask you this. What can they do on an individual level? Plant a victory garden? Eat less meat? What do you recommend?
Well, that's the question I get more frequently than any other. What can I do? And I think people expect me to say, you know, change your light bulbs and recycle your newspapers. And those things are important. But we now have to change the system. I don't mean a political revolution. I mean we have to restructure the world economy in a way that will dramatically reduce carbon emissions, that will use water much more efficiently, that will reduce soil erosion. We need to do these things, and this is such a monumental sort of undertaking. It's going to take a lot of political support. Whereas in the past, we've talked about saving the planet, what's at stake now is civilization itself. And we all have a stake in that. So it's becoming politically active. Pick an issue that's important to you. If it's creating a world-class recycling program in your community or helping to close coal-fired power plants or joining a population group to stabilize world population, this is where our future is going to be determined.
Lester Brown's new book is called World on the Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. Thank you so much.
Steve, my pleasure. Thank you for focusing attention on these issues.